There's a story that I heard. I don't know if it's true or not, but there was a preacher who was preaching and some woman fell asleep. And so the preacher said to her husband, "Wake her up." Because, you know, preachers don't like that when people fall asleep. And the gentleman looked at the preacher and he said, "You wake her up. You put her to sleep." So I resonate with that. If someone falls asleep, you know whose fault it is? It's the speaker's fault. So I've come up with an idea. If someone falls asleep, I think this is going to work really well. If someone falls asleep, I'm going to start clapping. And everyone clap with me, and I'm going to be looking at that person who's sleeping. When they wake up, this is what they'll do. I'm confident they will not fall asleep again. No, we won't do that. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to keep this message moving along, because at this hour, it is time that a lot of people start falling asleep. Now, what I'm going to do is, before I get into the main meat of the topic, I'm going to be real vulnerable, and I'm going to share a personal story about myself and my own personal struggles I've had with a mental health challenge that I've suffered. Actually, it was a mental illness, or you could say mental disorder. Nowadays, politically correct, we like to call it a mental challenge. I will never forget that Saturday. I started having recurrent thoughts in my head. Until then, I'd always experienced great health. These thoughts would not go away, and it got worse. And they started leading me to do compulsions, things that just weren't normal. And if I didn't follow through with the compulsions, it would start leading to anxiety. So I saw a healthcare worker, then I saw a doctor, and I was incredulous the day that my physician looked at me with a very concerned look on his face, and he said, "There is no cure for OCD, but that they can manage this." I was shocked. I was like, I can't live like this for the rest of my life. Now, there's stereotypes about OCD, people being germaphobes or washing their hands and locking doors. I didn't have any of those things. It comes in a myriad of forms. And I'll share later some of the things that I had to struggle with. But what happens is when you have a compulsion, and it doesn't make any sense. You know, for someone to have to wash their hands, it doesn't make any sense. But they're compelled to do it. And when they don't, it'll literally drive them crazy. So what's the option? Feel crazy and have anxiety and then have a panic attack, or go and wash your hands, even if you're doing it over and over. And like I mentioned, that wasn't the issues that I went through. But so first they put you on one medication, then they put you on another medication, then they put you on another medication. One morning I woke up with fear just ripping through my body. I go see the psychiatrist and he goes, "Oh, we just need to put you on this medication." And sure enough, it just takes away the fear. But you know, because I'm a dentist, I have a drug handbook, and I look up these drugs. And I look it up. It's Zyprexa. It's an antipsychotic. Great. Now I'm on an antipsychotic. Besides all the cocktail and the buffet of medicines they put me on and all the side effects that come with it. My wife that year, she was a single mother. I was checked out, and there's nothing she could do to help me. It was hands down the most painful experience of my life. OCD is not a disease that bothers. It is a disease that tortures. Dr. Nelly just talked about Elijah. When he was depressed, he wanted to die. See, when you have cancer, you have hope to live. When you have depression or a mental illness, you don't have hope. That's why you would rather die. I wished I had cancer so I could die. I was in a retreat center for about 19 days, and most of the people there had cancers, and a lot of these people were getting better with this lifestyle program that they had there, and all the people there wanted so much to live, and I wanted what they had so I could get out of this situation, so I could die. In the housing that I was with, there was a young man with his wife and kids. And he was dying of cancer. He wanted so much to live. And here, I wished I had what he had. And I'm trying to paint a picture for you what it's like for people who have a mental illness. You know, before I ever had this challenge in my own life, I would have looked at someone with a mental illness and I would have thought, just snap out of it. Trying to tell someone with a mental illness to snap out of it is like trying to tell someone who is deaf to try and listen just a little bit harder and they might hear. It doesn't work that way. Now, dentistry already requires detailed attention. Try compounding being a dentist with OCD. Just as an example, I would do a filling, and it just wasn't right. So what am I going to do? Take it out and redo it. Second one, am I happy with it? No. I'm starting to have anxiety build up. You know why? Because I'm about to do it again for the third time possibly. What do you think my assistant's thinking? This guy's crazy. How do you think the patient's feeling? Maybe a little bit frustrated by this time, maybe? How do you think I'm feeling? Like I'm crazy, and I know it. It doesn't make any sense. But otherwise, I know I'm going to be dealing with the anxiety, which could turn it into a full-blown panic attack. I spent much time in prayer crying out to God that year. Now, I want to share a quote from a book that I really, really appreciate. It's called The Ministry of Healing. In fact, one of the chapters of this book is called Mind Cure, and that's where the name of this conference came from, Mind Cure. And I'm going to have you read this with me. God never leads his children otherwise than they would choose to be led if they could see the end from the beginning and discern the glory of the purpose which they are fulfilling as co-workers with him. I clung on to this promise that truly, if I could really see the beginning from the end, that I wouldn't choose any way. It didn't make any sense to me. You know, C.S. Lewis says that God whispers to us in our pleasures and he shouts to us in our pains. And believe me, the pain was there. And this goes along with something that's very similar in Romans 8:28 that most of us are probably familiar with, right? That all things work together for good to them who love the Lord and to them who are called according to the purpose. I clung to God. I just clung to prayer. And you know what? God sent the right people in my life at the right time. A friend of mine, her husband was going through health problems himself. And he had graduated with me. And he was a dentist. And he had some issues. And she told me that I need to get tested for mercury toxicity. I'm desperate for anything. Someone gives me a recommendation, I'm looking to check it out. And so anyways, I went and saw a naturopathic physician. I got tested, and on one of my tests, my mercury level was all the way across the chart. Do you know how much of a relief that was? Hoping that this could be the problem? Anyways, I had asked somebody for prayer, and they had recommended this physician. And so I went and saw the physician, and he was confident that this was the problem. What was causing my OCD was the toxicity in my body. So he started detoxing me. To make a long story short, probably took about 6 months or so, going through chelation, and I get my life back. Now, just at the right time, you know, God sent the right people to help me, because all I could do was just hang on every day, living a tortured life. A college coach once told me when I was about 22, he told me, "You can't understand happiness until you've experienced pain." At that age, I couldn't comprehend what he was talking about. I can now. Listen to this quote by Todd Sivan. "If one has never faced adversity and witnessed what down and dumps actually smells like, how can the scent of a rose ever truly be appreciated? Are you thankful just to feel normal?" I took that for granted. I always had great health. I didn't take just feeling normal for something to be thankful for. Now, if I'm having a bad day, all I have to do is think back of my experience and everything gets better. I'm just thankful just to feel normal. And the thing is, would I ever want to go and experience that again? No, I would never want to experience that or wish that on anybody. But having been through it, I am thankful for the life lessons that I've learned as a result of this. Now, I'm going to share with you just a couple points of why I'm sharing this personal story. One is because there is such a strong stigma about mental illnesses. And I want to help to abate that stigma and not propagate that stigma. And it's only through education and understanding that we can do this. What do people with mental illnesses look like? They look just like me, and they look just like you. They look like your family members and your friends. And I will submit that I believe now that the stigma has gotten to be a little bit less. And you know why? Just purely for the ubiquity and the pervasiveness of this nature. I'd be surprised if there was a single person in here who they themselves have not struggled in one way or another, or they don't have a close family member or friend who has gone through some kind of a mental health disorder. Secondly, I want to make a point that because of the title of this presentation, about the secrets of emotional health, it's not about detoxification. You might think, oh, it's about detoxing. However, I want to underscore that this is a treatment modality that is often overlooked or it's not even considered. And an analogy that I like to use in my office is that, you know, if you're stepping on a thumbtack, I don't care how much carrot juice you drink or how much charcoal you use or what kind of natural remedies you do or whatever you do, if you want to feel better, you got to get that thumbtack out of your foot. And so proper diagnosis is very key. And, you know, a lot of times, sometimes, as we know in medicine today, sometimes they're just treating the symptoms. But I think the key is if you've got someone that you know that's suffering, exhaust and look at all the possible causes of why they may be suffering. Now, just a few facts about mental illness. This is an ABC News article. 1 in 5 Americans has mental illness, very rampant. 350 million globally suffer from depression. Globally, depression accounts for 41% of all years spent living with mental or behavioral disorders. 15% accounts for those who suffer anxiety. This is a CNN article highlighting the stigma attached to mental illness. It reads, "Breaking the taboo. It's time to talk about mental health." Now, there is an organization called Time to Change, and they worked to try to end mental health discrimination, and this is what they say. In reality, 9 in 10 people tell us at Time to Change that they face stigma and discrimination because of their mental health problem. What's more, over half, 58%, that say that stigma and discrimination is as bad or as worse than the illness itself. So someone who has a mental health illness is doubly challenged. One, they're struggling with the disabilities and the symptoms of the mental illness. Second, they've got to deal with the stereotypes and the prejudices that result from misconceptions about mental illness. As a result of both, people with mental illness are robbed of the opportunities that define a good quality of life. So you can imagine, because of the experience that I have been through personally at a young age, I greatly value health, especially mental health. You know, there's a cliche saying everyone knows, happy wife, happy life, right? Well, there's one that our friend of my brother and I's, he's from Myanmar, he said it this way: when the wife is happy, the whole world is happy. It goes the same for the brain. When the brain is happy, everything else can be all right. Now on to the main topic of this presentation, which is, the title is Emotional Health's Best Kept Secret Therapy. In 1999, 230,000 students from around the world took a standardized test. It's called the TIMSS, Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study, which evaluates knowledge of math and science. How do you think the students in America did? Good or bad? Bad? Okay. Now, as a whole, the U.S. students ranked 18th in science and 19th in math. However, there is a conspicuous exception. There was one school district that decided to take this test on their own, not as a part of the rest of the United States. And their school district took this test, 97% of their 8th graders. So not merely just the brightest and best, but 97% of their 8th graders. How do you think they did in science? Can anyone take a guess? What's that? They did very well. They got number one in science in the world. How do you think they did in math? Pretty good. They got number six. They got six only behind 5 Asian countries: Singapore, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Japan. Now, you know that stereotype about Asians and their math? Apparently, it must be true. Now I can say that because I am Asian, but I'm pretty average at math and terrible at computers. Now, what is it about the school district in Illinois, the Naperville School District 203, that the students achieve such astonishing results on their international standardized test? Why do you think they're such a statistical outlier? Okay. Now, these results to me were very fascinating, and you can read about it in Dr. John Ratty's best-selling book called Spark. He's a clinical psychiatrist at the School of Medicine, Harvard, and he shares about what happened here, okay? So, things in Naperville got started as things often do. Equal parts self-preservation and idealism. There was a PE teacher there named Phil Lawler, and he had read in a newspaper article that, this was in the 1990s, reporting that the health of youth children was declining. It said the reason they weren't healthy was that they weren't very active. He says these days everybody knows we have an obesity epidemic, but back in the 90s, that kind of an article was unusual. He thought, we have these kids every day. Shouldn't we be able to affect their health? And he thought, if this is our business, we are going bankrupt. Now, he had a really respectable resume, but he kind of felt like he was in a profession that really wasn't respected, and he wanted to make a difference. So him and his staff took a look at their PE program, and they found that, you know, a lot of the stuff that they did was really not a lot of activity. When you play baseball, what are you doing most of the time? Standing around. So instead, they said, let's change the sports into fitness. One of the things they did was every week, each child had to run a mile. How do you think the kids liked that? That was received with groans. To give kids that are non-athletes a good shot at marks, they bought these Schwinn Aerodyne bikes, and you can pedal on these bikes and get extra credit. If you ever had a personal best, that means, you know, let's just say it took you 10 minutes to run a mile and you did it faster, then you could also raise your grade. So, and they dubbed this principle called the new PE. Students would be assessed on effort rather than skill. Now, He would also hold this conference in the springtime for a lot of PE teachers to get together and discuss ideas and have vendors giving out stuff. And he got his hands on this newfangled device back then, which was worth hundreds of dollars, which was a heart rate monitor. So he put this heart rate monitor on a student. She ran, and then he measured her stats. She was a thin girl in sixth grade, not the least bit athletic. When Lawler downloaded her stats, he couldn't believe what he found. Her average heart rate was 187. As an 11-year-old, her max heart rate would have been roughly 209. When she was coming to the finish, she was at about 207. She was coming in full tilt. He says, ding, ding, ding. He says, you got to be kidding me. Normally, I would have gone to that girl and said, you need to get your butt in gear, little lady. It was really at that moment that caused dramatic changes in our overall program. The heart rate monitors were a springboard for everything. I started thinking back to all the kids we must have turned off to exercise because we weren't able to give them credit. I didn't have an athlete in class who knew how to work as hard as that little girl. He realized that being fast didn't necessarily have anything to do with being fit. One of his favorite statistics is that only 3% of adults go on and continue to do the sports that they did when they were younger. And so while most of the schools are in favor of cutting down PE time in favor of more academic time because of that act, which is called No Child Left Behind, what they're doing at this school is they're doing the opposite. Having these kids spend more time. Do you know how many hours a day most kids spend in front of a screen? The last I heard is about 6.5 hours. That equates to a lot of inactivity with our young people these days. So let me just describe to you Dr. Ratty when he first visited Naperville and his experience. He goes, the first time I visited, it was just before school let out for the summer. But you wouldn't have known that by watching gym class at Madison Junior High. There must have been 30 kids jumping around with the sort of energy and enthusiasm you would only expect to see at the beginning of the school year, lining up to get on this climbing wall, arguing about who was going to get to use a new exercise bike attached to a video game monitor, running wildly on treadmills, playing a video game called Dance Dance Revolution, where you dance on a control pad. They were all wearing heart rate monitors, and most important, they were all engaged. Now, you know when you were in school, there was always that kid who had ants in his pants? You know the one that's always like, can't you sit still? Well, I was that person. I could have benefited from being in a school like this. The essence of what they did was teach fitness, not sports. The underlying philosophy is that if PE class can be used to instruct kids how to monitor and maintain their own fitness and health, then the lessons they learn will serve them for life. So, a nonprofit agency, PE for Life, what they did was they hired Lawler, brought in, I think, about 1,000 PE teachers from different schools, and they were teaching them what they're doing over here. One such teacher was Tim McCord from Pennsylvania, Titusville, Pennsylvania. He was from this defunct industrial town, population about 6,000 people. In the 1800s, they had an oil well that was hugely successful. The oil was come and gone, so did the economy. The median income in that town is like $25,000. 16% of the town is below the poverty line. We're talking about a real low-income town. McCord comes, and he goes back to school, and overnight, they just start changing their school with support from the administrators and the people around. In fact, they even lessen school time by like 10 minutes so they can add more time for activity. So what's the result? And I share this so that you see that Naperville was not just some exception. Since the program started in 2000, the standardized test scores of Titusville students have risen from below the state average to 17% above it in reading, and 18% above it in math. Equally important are the psychosocial effects McCord has noticed. I love this one. Not a single fist fight among the 550 junior high kids since 2000. Do you see that this is not only helping them do well academically, but socially as well? So this is a little story that I just want to share because I enjoyed this. So the district bootstrap story brought in prompted visits from state representatives and even the president of the CDC, Centers for Disease Control. During one such show and tell, McCord led a group past the junior high's climbing wall. That's kind of cool, wouldn't it be cool to have a climbing wall at your school? He noticed a girl named Stephanie stuck about halfway up. Bookish and a little heavy set, she was on display for everyone to see her fail. But as her classmates noticed her struggling, they began cheering, "Go, Stephanie!" She made it to the top. And McCord spoke to her later. She started to cry and couldn't believe the other kids were cheering her on. McCord says, she said it helped her pull herself up. What Naperville provides is a powerful case study on how aerobic activity can transform not only the body, but also the mind. See, when the students in Naperville go for a run, They are more prepared to learn in their classes. Their brains are primed. Their senses are heightened. Their focus and mood are improved, and they are less fidgety and tense, and they feel more motivated and invigorated. And this also happens to be a wonderful template for reshaping society. Now, this connection between exercise and the brain, is this just causal or just a mere coincidence? As far as studies go, Virginia Tech did a study, and what they discovered that cutting gym class and allocating more time for math, science, and reading did not improve test scores as the administrators thought it would. But the most telling study comes from the California Department of Education. Over a five-year period, the CDE was able to consistently show that students with higher fitness scores also have higher test scores. So, what's been the result? The Naperville School District turned their student body perhaps into one of the most fittest school districts in the nation. Their obesity rate, 3%. You know what the national rate is? 30%. What's more stunning is that their program has also turned their students into some of the smartest in the nation. And based on some of the stories, it sounds like they are socially and mentally well-adjusted as well. So as politicians and pundits sound alarm about faltering education in the United States and about our students being ill-equipped to succeed in today's technology-driven economy, Naperville stands out as an extra bit of good news. So, what allows us to absorb the material is where the revolutionary new science comes into play. And I'm going to be sharing about this. In addition to priming our state of mind, exercise influences learning directly at the cellular level, improving the brain's potential to log in and process new information. Now, due to the sake of time, I'm going to only highlight a few of these different things because there's just so many other things like ADHD and hormonal change and all the things that that exercise can have an impact on. But learning, depression, anxiety, stress, addiction, and anti-aging. Now, as I was going through the notes, there was just so much stuff. I just started cutting out the stuff, and I'm going to try to keep the scientific-y stuff as minimal as possible so I don't lose any of you guys. Now, I'm sure most of you guys would agree. The main reasons for why most people exercise is for what? One is to lose weight, and the other is to shape their muscles and their bodies, right? I spend quite a lot of time in the gym, and there's mirrors everywhere for that particular reason. I find the difference between men and women, men, no matter what they look, when they look in the mirror, they like what they see, you know? Women are just the opposite. They may look great, they look in the mirror, they're not as happy, it seems, at what they see in the mirror. But that's one of the reasons why people exercise. What Dr. Ratty says is he tells his patients that the point of exercise is to build and condition the brain. Building muscles and conditioning the heart and lungs are essentially side effects. So I want to kind of change the way that we think, okay? Now, in order to understand how the brain works, there's just two concepts that you need to be familiar with. You've probably heard of neuroplasticity. It just means that the brain is not rigid like porcelain. It's more like Play-Doh. It's like muscle that can be sculpted. What neuroplasticity means is refers to the potential that the brain has to reorganize by creating new neural pathways to adapt as it needs. Now, for the better part of the 20th century, scientific dogma held that the brain was hardwired once fully developed in adolescence, meaning we're born with all the neurons we're going to get. If you grew up if you lived through the 80s like me, we were told that alcohol kills brain cells, and that's all you've got. So basically, don't drink alcohol. Well, guess what? Brain cells do grow back, and by the thousands. This is called neurogenesis, and this was discovered accidentally from a very unlikely source and conclusively published only in 1998, not too long ago. Cancer patients are sometimes injected with a dye that shows up in proliferating cells so that the spread of disease can be tracked. Researchers looked at the brains of terminally ill patients who had donated their bodies to science and found that their hippocampi were packed with a dye marker, proof that neurons were propagating and dividing, which is neurogenesis. With this, they formalized one of the biggest discoveries in neuroscience. Since then, scientists have been scrambling to understand how this neurogenesis occurs. Because this could be the key to discovering the cure for degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Now, the neuroscientists have discovered that when they have rodents running on a treadmill, it causes neurogenesis. It causes their brains to grow. So now they've got these little mice running on treadmills. Do you think they do that because they're interested in exercise? They don't care about exercise. They want to know what causes neurogenesis because that's where the money's at. Okay, and I was talking to John Shin, who's going to actually be here tomorrow. He's our speaker. He's from Mayo Clinic. He's in oncology. He's studying oncology in internal med. And it's the same thing with cancer. Are they looking for cures? That's what they're looking for. They're not looking for how to prevent cancer. That's not where the money's at. And so same thing. And so these scientists are studying, and here's the first. Here's a solid link between learning and neurogenesis that came from a study with mice. They placed mice in a rodent-sized pool with opaque water so they couldn't really see, and there was a platform under the water. So the mice have to figure out how to get to the platform as an escape well and see how well they can remember this from an earlier dip. So they had two sets of mice. One had run all night, five kilometers on a running wheel. The other were inactive. Both groups swam about the same rate, but the ones that exercised, they made a beeline. They knew where it was. While the sedentary mice floundered about, when the mice were dissected, the active mice had twice as many new stem cells in the hippocampus as the inactive ones. The scientist Gage says there is a significant correlation between the total number of cells and a mouse's ability to perform a complex task. And if you block neurogenesis, mice can't recall information. So what is it that helps us in school? It's recall. Okay? Could it be that these students at Naperville who are doing all this exercise are actually having neurogenesis going on? Possible. Neuroscientists have discovered that the brain and body are elevated with all kinds of different chemicals when we move and we exercise. Now, I'm not going to bore you with the names, but some of these names are like insulin-like growth factor, vascular endothelial growth factor, and fibroblast growth factor. But I want to highlight one in particular. It's called BDNF. This is like Miracle-Gro for your brain. It's like fertilizer for our neurons. When early researchers sprinkled this onto neurons on a petri dish, you know what these neurons did? Automatically sprouted new branches, producing the same structural growth required for learning. Can you see how it's like Miracle-Gro for the brain? Who here could use some more Miracle-Gro for your brain? Great. Most of us here. Fantastic. German researchers found in a study in 2007 that people learned vocabulary words 20% faster following exercise than they did before exercise, and that the rate of learning correlated directly with levels of BDNF. Along with this, people with a gene variation that robs them of BDNF are more likely to have learning deficiencies. So guess when was my favorite time to sit down, start reading through everything I can find, and put this presentation together? After I go finish a run. That was the best time because I knew, I felt like I can focus. And of course, knowing this information, I'm like, okay, I'm sitting here, neurochemicals are firing in my brain, I can focus and I can do my best work. Thomas Crook, clinical psychologist, memory researcher, says, cardiovascular health is more important than any other single factor in preserving and improving learning and memory. He says, you're working out your brain at the same time as your heart. Parents, do you want your kids to do well in school? Get them away from the screens and have them start going out and riding their bikes and make them go for a run. Now, this I definitely want to highlight depression because it's so ubiquitous. This is a study that was done at the Duke University, and I love this acronym, SMILE. And it stands for Standard Medical Intervention and Long-Term Exercise, just comparing medicine with exercise. And what they did was they had three groups. One group, they just exercised. One group took Zoloft or sertraline, a very common antidepressant. And the third group took the antidepressant and also exercised. What was the result? And all they did was they exercised 30 minutes a day, three times a week. Is that a lot? That's not even a lot. 30 minutes a day, three times a week. The result, all three groups showed a significant drop in depression. And about half of each group was completely out of the woods in remission. Blumenthal concluded that exercise was as effective as medication. This is as black and white as psychiatry can deliver. This should be taught in every medical school, driven home with insurance companies, and posted on the bulletin boards of every nursing home in the country where nearly a fifth of the residents have depression. When I was sick, that's what they would do, constantly be putting me on medication. Would you rather be put on medication, or would you rather exercise? And I'm going to explain the science behind this. Now, before I get to that, the New York Times actually posted this study in 2000 in the New York Times. However, it was buried on page 14 of the health and fitness section. So, why is it that exercise is so great for depression? Now, most of the drugs that are used in psychiatry today to improve mental health target one of these three neurotransmitters. And you've heard these talked about by Dr. Nedley and some of the other speakers. Serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. Most of you have probably heard of serotonin, kind of thought of as the happy hormone, and know that a lack of it is associated with depression. The class of antidepressants most commonly used are called SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And what they do is they basically, they're used to prevent the reabsorption of serotonin back into the nerve cells. Basically, we want serotonin. And so Dr. Ratty says, he tells people, going for a run is like taking a little bit of Prozac, you get serotonin, and taking a little bit of Ritalin, you get dopamine. Now, when I was sick, they kept putting me on different kinds of antidepressants and medications, okay? And kept putting them on more and more. But here's the difference when your body creates this. He says it's a good metaphor that running is like taking a bit of Prozac and some Ritalin, but the deeper explanation is that exercise balances these neurotransmitters along with the rest of the neurochemicals in the brain. Because, see, before they thought maybe it was just a lack of a little neurotransmitter that's causing depression. It's not as simple as that because it's so complex in there. One neurotransmitter doesn't elicit just a crisp response. It's a cascade. It's a domino effect. Do you want some physician trying to figure out, let's give you a little bit of this. Well, that doesn't work. Let's give you a little bit of this. Let's just raise this. Or would you rather have your body that was created wonderfully and fearfully made to naturally adjust those levels to the level that it's supposed to be at? And that is what exercise does. The more we find out about depression, we realize it is very complex. Okay? Now, one of the things that we all need to know is that toxic stress erodes the connections in the brain between the billions of nerve cells, and chronic depression shrinks certain areas of the brain. But what most people don't know, conversely, is that exercise unleashes a cascade of neurochemicals and growth factors. Let me go back to that slide. And growth factors that can reverse this process, physically bolstering the brain's infrastructure. This is another one that just seems to be growing epidemically, anxiety. You know, as a dentist, I get my patient health history forms, and I look in there, and I see the psychiatry treatments, depression, anxiety. It is so rampant today. Anxiety is it emotionally feels like fear. Now, when you've been on an airplane, and the airplane drops, and you get that, your stomach drops, and you get that fear momentarily, for you to feel like that, that's normal. But when it's over and your brain tells you that everything's okay, but you continue to feel fear, that is not normal. When a person worries when there is no real threat to the point that they cannot function normally, that's an anxiety disorder. Now, there's many types of anxiety disorders, but one of the things that they all have in common is an irrational dread. A paralyzing, and it can result in a paralyzing fear and lead to an unreasonable compulsion. For example, to avoid certain places or to avoid spiders or... For those who might be agoraphobic, fear of open places. Now, if the anxiety continues, then it can go right into a panic attack. Now, I've had a panic attack before, as you know, because I was sick. And I know if someone's genuinely had a panic attack by the way they describe it. And these are the things that they would say. My heart was beating so fast, I thought I was going to die. Or I thought my heart was going to explode. And that's exactly what a panic attack feels like. Now, I don't know a lot about OCD, but I probably know more than most of you because I read up on it as much as I could. But with OCD, it's a communication breakdown. You know, when someone has OCD and they lock the door, normally your brain tells you, you lock the door. It's over. With the OCD person, something is not communicating properly, and it's similar with anxiety. You know, your brain tells you, should tell you, it's okay. The fear is past. There's nothing to worry about. And yet, your body, your memory keeps replaying this, okay? Does anyone remember from Dr. Nelly's talk of what happens when you take benzos? Benzo stands for benzodiazepines. The most common ones are like Valium and Xanax. He mentioned when you take benzos, what decreases? Anyone remember? GABA, right? Which is gamma-aminobutyric acid. So what do you think happens when you exercise? Moving the body triggers the release of gamma-aminobutyric acid, known as GABA, which is the brain's major inhibitory neurotransmitter and the primary target for most of our anti-anxiety medicines. So having normal levels of GABA is crucial to stopping at the cellular level the self-fulfilling prophecy of anxiety. It interrupts the obsessive feedback loop within the brain. In addition to that, we also know that when we exercise, what do we get? Serotonin. We already talked about that, right? And serotonin works at nearly every junction of the anxiety circuitry. Now, I'm going to skip this study for the sake of time. But not only are we producing certain neurochemicals when we're exercising, exercise is a great distraction from anxiety because you're taking your mind off of that. It also works to help desensitize. One of the things Anxiety brings a sympathetic nervous system into effect, and so you sense your heart rate and breathing increasing. And when that happens, anxiety starts going up. But what normally happens when you run or do some kind of exercise? That's a normal part of exercise, right? Heart rate goes up and you start breathing. And so what you're doing is you're connecting something such as your heart rate and your breathing with an aerobic exercise that is a positive activity. And as they associate it with something positive, then this will help them with their anxiety. And this is something typical that we do as dentists. We get patients all the time, because I have friends here who are dentists. Patients are freaked out because they've had a bad experience and they're afraid of the dentist. And by explaining things to them, by helping them have an experience that is painless, and after they go through a couple of visits, then they become desensitized to that fear, and we can literally reverse anxiety. Now, stress is something that everyone here can relate to. Now, when they did these studies with rats, they subjected them to stress, and what they used for stress was cold water. Those who had been allowed to run beforehand reacted less to the stress than those that hadn't. In the critters, at least, the new brain cells created by exercise appeared to help them resist stress. So one of the, I don't know if it's theory or it's for a fact, but one of the things that happens is, like our muscles, what happens with our muscles when we exercise our muscles? They tear, and what happens? They grow stronger. When we exercise, there are molecular byproducts that can damage the cells, but under normal circumstances, repair mechanisms leave cells hardier for future challenges. And so these stresses are positive stressors. So this is a story that Dr. Ratty tells that I really enjoy, only because my wife and I recently went through a house remodel, and we know how stressful it is with different people coming into the house, all the decisions you have to make, and they leave a mess every time they come, and half the time they're doing things wrong. And part of it is probably because we, you know, didn't pick the best people, possibly. But Susan was active, then became forced to stick around the house for contractors due to a large remodeling job. And dealing with all that stress and having to stay home, she started drinking a glass of wine for coping. Soon she became addicted to wine. So as she was talking with Dr. Ratty, they discovered that, you know, she used to be athletic and she likes to jump rope. So they suggested, why don't you have some jump ropes in the house? So whenever she'd feel the stress coming on, you know what she'd do? Start skipping rope. Here's what she says. And eventually she had stashed jump ropes on different floors of her house, and she'd been able to stop using wine to relieve stress. Even with just those short bursts of activity, she immediately felt more in control, like the master of her own fate. She also felt a genuine relief, less tension in her muscles, and less distracting activity in her mind. She explains it this way. I feel like it kind of reboots my mind. Now, I'm sorry, reboots my brain. Now, as a dentist, I have no shortage of stress. The work of a dentist is not stressful. I think it's very, very easy. You know what makes my work stressful? It's the interesting characters that come through our door, personalities. It's probably like being a waitress. Probably 80% of all your customers are wonderful, and there's that 5% that can really make things stressful for you. And so this is a quote that runs through my mind pretty regularly at work. You're only one workout away from a good mood. And usually my routine, as soon as I'm done from work, I'm going to go join a running group, and we're going to go run 4 to 6 miles, or I'm going to go hit the pool and start doing laps, or go cycling. And so it's something that you can always remember. When you're not feeling well, it's only one workout away. Something no one ever regretted. No one ever regretted a workout. No one had a workout and go, oh, man, I regret having that workout. And so it's something I want to encourage everyone, something that's going to benefit. Dr. Ratty says most people have no idea why exercise makes us feel so good. Most assume it's because we're burning off stress or reducing muscle tension or boosting endorphins. So listen to this carefully. But the real reason we feel so good when we get our blood pumping is that it makes the brain function at its best. On to addiction. I love this story. In 2006, the New York Marathon, 35,000 people ran. Of those 35,000 people, 16 were former drug addicts. You know what they all had in common? Many of them were homeless, imprisoned, or destitute when they checked into Odyssey House, a rehab program in New York. They have a running program there called Run for Your Life. And what they've discovered is those who become serious runners stay in treatment about twice as long as the non-active residents. Because remember, with drug addicts, what's the key for recovery? Whoever is willing to stay in treatment the longest. And so Peter Provey, the director of this Odyssey House, he says, the drug for the addict becomes everything. Take it away, and there is an empty vessel at the core of the body and mind. What better way to start filling that vessel than exercise? So it's about replacing a negative habit with a positive habit. He strongly believes that exercise can serve as an antidote and as a type of inoculation against addiction. But now, neurobiology is just catching up with what Provey has been experiencing for the last 20 years. So most of us all have heard of the runner's high. That's why people love to run. And your body starts making these chemicals, endorphins, and you just feel this euphoric feeling. But now what they're also discovering is this class of chemicals called endocannabinoids. If you look at the word in the middle, cannabinoids, like cannabis. Endorphins is to morphine, like endocannabinoids is to THC, the active compound of marijuana. Could you see why running would be so great for people who are coming out of addiction? Here they're replacing a negative habit with something to do. At the same time, when they're running, their brains are firing, and endocannabinoids are produced in the body that elicit the same effect as a drug, dulling pain and producing euphoric feelings along with endorphins, and act as the body's extra strength aspirin. In 2003, Georgia Tech University did a study on the effects of exercise on the endocannabinoid system, and they had these fit males for 50 minutes, 70-80% of their maximum heart rate. They discovered that the levels of anandamide, a form of endocannabinoid neurotransmitter, nearly doubled. So, all these people at the Odyssey House were drug addicts, and we know, we've been told that drugs will do what? Fry your brain. And now what are they doing? Unleashing things that will help their brain, releasing chemicals, and doing things to reboot their brain. Now, I saw this quote, and I just wanted to add this one. I like this. I like how when I work out, my brain makes drugs. See, before I learned all this stuff, I always enjoyed exercising. But when you have knowledge and you understand what it's doing for you, it only makes my experience of exercise that much more enjoyable because I know it's doing so many great things for my health and for my mind. Anti-aging. I'm not into cosmetic surgery or Botox, but I am over 40 now, and I realize as I get older, I'm starting to notice those things. My hair's thinning out. Hair starts growing in places that it used to not grow. And can anyone else relate? Could you use some anti-aging in your life? And, you know, one of the things is the caps of our chromosomes have these things that protect our DNA called telomeres. And as we get older, it's a fact that our telomeres get shorter. They've discovered with exercise, our telomeres actually get longer. So this is a proven anti-aging remedy. Here's an ABC News article. Alzheimer's disease. Exercise may reduce senior moments. So Dr. Ratty says, the point I've tried to make, that exercise is the single most powerful tool you have to optimize your brain function, is based on evidence I've gathered from hundreds and hundreds of research papers, most of them published only within the past decade. For the sake of time, I can't talk about all the other stuff that he mentions, and that's why I only just highlighted a few of them, but I would encourage you to pick up a copy of Dr. Ratty's book called Spark, and I think you'll just be amazed with all the blessings that exercise can do. You know, before the 1800s, physicians actually believed that there was a connection between the body and the mind. You know, 200 years ago, you were sick, they might tell you, go by the seaside, take some time off, go to a retreat center, and you would, and you'd have fresh air, less stress, and you'd start getting better. And then you know what? That all stopped. You know why that all stopped? With the introduction when they discovered bacteria and toxins. Oh, so that causes disease. So now the focus went there and it came to antibiotics and all of this. But now doctors are starting to discover that there is a real connection between the body and the mind. A very strong connection. Genetics loads a gun. What pulls the trigger? Lifestyle and, I just include this one, environment. Because now we live in a toxic environment. It's all around us, right? Preservatives, toxins, GMOs, heavy metals, BPAs. Now add to that list, you can't get away from this one, Wi-Fi. It's all around us because most of us have smartphones. And so this is an article about the damages of Wi-Fi, and it talks about how it affects cell growth with these ninth graders, Danish ninth graders, experience difficulty concentrating after sleeping with their cell phones by their head. They performed an experiment to test the effect of wireless Wi-Fi routers on garden crests. One set of plants was grown in a room free of wireless radiation. The other group grew next to the two routers that released the same amount of radiation as a cell phone. The result, the plants nearest to radiation didn't grow. Also derails brain function. Just as the Danish high schoolers noticed problems with concentration, scientists have begun to look at the impact of 4G radiation on brain function. Using MRI technology, research performed found that persons exposed to 4G radiation had several areas of reduced brain activity. So my point is this. It's not about trying to sleep without your cell phone next to our head, because the stuff is everywhere. We live in a toxic, polluted world, and we are bombarded from every side. You know, the world that we live in now is not the same as 200 years ago. 200 years ago, most people walked, right? Unless you're royalty, most people walked. If not, if you're working, you're plowing next to a cow or you're riding on a horse. Now, you see these kids with these little hoverboard things? I mean, can we get any lazier? We just don't walk, and we're just plastered in front of a screen. And then we've got man-made pollutants everywhere. And so the thing is that we have to proactively make choices to fortify our minds and our bodies to fight off against these things in our environment that are competing for our health. Use exercise as a proactive defense. It's really simple. Great mind, it really comes down to this. Nutrition, rest, and exercise. So if you don't remember anything from this presentation, I just want you to remember this one point. Inactivity shrinks the brain. Depression can shrink certain parts of the brain. Toxic stress erodes connections in the brain. And conversely, exercise unleashes a cascade of neurochemicals and growth factors that can reverse this process, physically bolstering the brain's infrastructure. And that's what we called it. Joyce actually came up with the title of this, and I thought it was a great title, because emotional health's best kept secret. Everyone knows about exercise, but very few people know about how much it can benefit your brain. Now, for those of you who know me, you might be like, well, I know Calvin. He's not that smart. To that, my defense is, just imagine if I didn't exercise as much as I would, where would I be? Now, if you're struggling with any issues of the mind, I'd encourage you to give exercise a fair shot. The immediate benefits are it may make you smarter, think clearly, and feel great. And of course, the long-term benefits are improving health and reducing the chances of getting degenerative diseases that affect the mind. Now, hopefully by now you're convinced that exercise is very important for the brain, okay? But this presentation will do you no good unless you start applying these things into your life. So I want to switch gears just for the final little bit of time we have. And I want to talk just a little bit about exercise. Now, I could do a whole presentation on exercise, which we don't have time for, but just a few things that might help you. Based on the study by Duke University, how much did they exercise? 30 minutes? How many times a week?
Three.
Just three. I would say at a minimum, if you're going to exercise, that's the minimum amount you should exercise. Okay? But you should exercise. I would recommend, and it varies for every individual. It varies on your situation. My recommendation, based on everything that I've read and my personal experiences, 5 hours a week. 1 hour a day, 5 days a week. And I'm going to put this into perspective for you because most of you are thinking, I don't have that kind of time. Okay? In a week, there's 168 hours. You know what percentage of the week is 5 hours? It's 3% of your total time. If you think, how much of your time are you inactive? That 97% of your time, you're not really that active. Is 3% a huge amount of time to devote to activity? So that is what I would recommend. Now, here's a question. What is the best exercise? Okay? Let's consider the butterfly swim stroke. One of the most taxing movements in sports. The butterfly requires greater energy than bicycling at 14 miles an hour, running at a 10-minute mile, playing competitive basketball, or carrying furniture upstairs. Burns huge calories, requires huge amount of oxygen, and builds up your endurance. It's an amazing exercise. How many people here can do the butterfly? I am very impressed. That is very impressive, okay? I swim every week. I haven't tried the butterfly, but I don't think I could do the butterfly. That is very impressive, okay? But the majority of the people here cannot do the butterfly, okay? So here's the answer to the best exercise, okay? The best answer is whatever you love to do that's going to raise your heart rate. That is the best exercise because sustainability is the most important thing. It could be the best exercise, and if you don't do it, it's not going to do you any good. So find out what that is. If you like to garden, great garden, but make sure you're doing it and you're raising your heart rate. You've got to do that in order to get the benefits for your brain. Now, I think running is one of the best things you can do. However, not everyone can run. And if you cannot, then walking is great. If you have to walk, here's the best thing. Walk in intervals. Walk slow and then walk fast and walk slow so at least you're raising your heart rate. And if you're able to walk in the woods, and that's a whole nother study, but when you walk in the woods, there are these volatile organic compounds called phytoncides that are antibacterial, antifungal, and increases natural killer cell activity, which fights against tumors and cancer. And so I'm going to just kind of skip through the exercise part. Oh, another thing is it's great when you exercise if it requires coordination, like playing tennis, rock climbing, because that also exercises your brain versus just mundane walking on the sidewalk, which doesn't really require a lot of concentration to do. Now, I like this quote, those who do not find time for exercise will have to find time for illness. because I shared with you my personal experience and because I experienced health problems at a young age, I can value this quote. Okay? But most people, I have discovered that knowledge doesn't always equate into action. For example, people know that smoking causes cancer. Does that stop them from smoking? No. I have patients, when they come in for an oral cancer screen, they want me to do a thorough oral cancer screen. Do you know why? So they know that they don't have cancer, oral cancer, so they can continue chewing. Okay? And so my observations tell me that knowledge doesn't always translate into action very well. We learned yesterday about persistence and also self-control. And not everybody has this, right? Not everyone has self-control. They don't all have persistence. This is just a picture that I love. Can you imagine, you know, when you're 74, who would you like to be? Do you want your kids sitting on your lap because you're in a wheelchair, or do you want to be running around with your kids, with your grandkids? Okay, so I am going to share with you just a couple of reasons that compel me. I find these to be compelling motivations that help me and encourage me to do what I do and keep an active lifestyle of exercise. Okay, and in order to convey this point that I'm trying to make, I'm going to tell you a story about my favorite sports hero. Now, most of you probably know who he is because you've probably seen a YouTube clip of him. Now, his name is Dick Hoyt. Does anyone know who he is? Okay, there's a few. Okay, now, Dick Hoyt had a son named Rick. Rick was born, and he had the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck. He was deprived of oxygen. And so he was diagnosed as spastic quadriplegic with cerebral palsy. Can't walk or talk on his own. Now, so can you imagine for like a decade of his life, he's just trapped in a body. But he can think. He knows what's going on. And actually, I have his book, and I'm in the middle, almost through with his book. And it's just an amazing story that Rick shares about his life. But anyways, they had a communicating device, and he was able to communicate with his father. In fact, his autobiography is called One Letter at a Time because he can tap out one letter at a time to communicate. And so he shared with his father that he wanted to participate in a 5-mile benefit run for a lacrosse player who had been paralyzed in an accident. It was not the race, nor was it the running he would never be able to do that inspired this desire. It was Rick's compassionate nature and desire to help others that motivated him. There was one problem, though. His father was not a runner. He was 36 years old. But great fathers make sacrifices. Great fathers give up of their time, money, and physical energy for the sake of giving their children a better life, or sometimes merely a smile. Dick may not have been a runner, but as a great father, his son's request was all the motivation he needed. He agreed and pushed his son's wheelchair the full 5 miles, and they finished the race next to last. Look at the smile on that kid's face. What happened next changed the course of their life forever. After returning home, Rick typed out on his computer, "Dad, when I'm running, it feels like my disability disappears." How do you think a statement like that would make a father feel? He has a disabled child who cannot walk or speak, and he tells you that when he's running, with the aid of his father in a wheelchair, he feels like he's not disabled anymore. Dick immediately took to sacrificing his time and energy selflessly to be able to give that able-bodied feeling to his son. After their initial 5-mile run, Dick began running every day with a bag of cement in the wheelchair, while Rick was at school, unable to train with him. Now, I love this pic because anyone who's ran a marathon or a race knows what it feels like. Father is just plumb tuckered out from this race, and look at that smile on his son's face. Dick was able to improve his fitness so much that even with pushing his son, he was able to obtain a personal record of a 5K in 17 minutes. Only those people who run realize how fast that is. For those who run marathons, just to give you an idea, it is a dream of any marathoner to run a sub-3 marathon, a marathon in under 3 hours. I think only 1% of marathon runners can do that. You know what he ran it in? With his son in a wheelchair, he ran it in 2 hours and 40 minutes. Just to give you an idea, what are the Kenyans running this at? They're coming at about, I think, between 205 and 210. They're the fastest runners in the world. 2 hours and 40, pushing his son in a wheelchair. Over the next 3.5 decades, the pair set achieved and surpassed not only their goals, but also everyone's expectations of a father carrying, towing, and pushing his wheelchair-bound son. Their accomplishments as of 2014 include 1,100 endurance races, including marathons, duathlons, and triathlons. Among some of their greatest accomplishments, the Boston Marathon alone, they ran 32 times. They have done 6 full Ironmans. And adding to their list of achievements, one of their greatest challenges is they started in Santa Monica Pier in Los Angeles, and they ran and biked all the way across the United States to Boston in 1992, completing a full 3,735 miles in 45 days straight without taking a day off. Usually when people do that, they'll take one day off. And they did it nonstop. Neither Dick, who is 75, or Rick, who is around 53, are ready to retire yet. Dick Hoyt says they said that Rick would be a vegetable. He is now in his 50s, and they still haven't figured out what kind of a vegetable he is. Rick couldn't run without his father. His father wouldn't compete without his son. Dick is the body, and Rick is the heart. This picture is actually, I believe, a picture when they were going across the United States. Now, you can see why Dick Hoyt is one of my favorite sports heroes. You know, if I see Michael Jordan slamming dunks, you know, he can make me smile, but he can't make me cry. But Dick Hoyt, if you watch any of his videos, which most of you probably have, he can move a grown man to tears. He is an accomplished endurance athlete. Doing any of these events solo is hard enough, and he's carrying the weight of another man, his unselfish devotion to his son. Now, they have never broken a record for time, speed, or distance, but they have broken every record for dedication, perseverance, and commitment. Rick was once asked if he could give his father one thing. What would it be? Rick responded, "The thing I'd most like is for my dad to sit in the chair and I would push him for once." Joe Misner, a professor of communication and leadership, wrote, speaking of Dick Hoyt, "Here I saw a man pushing himself to the brink of what is possible with the human body. And for what? Not for fame, not for glory, not for riches, but simply for the opportunity to help his son feel free, if only for a few hours at a time." So I'm going to ask you this question. Why does Dick do this? Why?
Love.
That's right. It's a four-letter word for love. That's why he does this. To define love more carefully, we could not do this justice without looking in the Bible to see what the Bible says about love. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, here's what it says. It says, "Love seeks not his own." That principle says here that I am willing to put your needs, your wants, your desires, your dreams, what you want in front of mine. We are told in John 15, 13, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friend." What we find in love is this relentless sacrifice and focus on others. Love can motivate you to do things that you otherwise could not do. This kind of a selfless demonstration of love is not an isolated incident with the Hoyts, but it's ubiquitous. I'll give you a story about one of my patients. Her name is Cheryl, and she's 52, and she has a 30-year-old daughter with kidney failure. She's on a transplant list. They told her mother, "You need to quit smoking to be a possible kidney donor." She has smoked since she was 15. For 37 years, she couldn't quit smoking. But when they told her, and she tried everything, including hypnosis, all kinds of stuff to try to quit smoking. As soon as she found out that her daughter needed her kidney, she quit like that. Why? Because of love. Now, I'm going to be real vulnerable and I'm going to share the story. I debated whether I should share it or not. A lot of people have this idea that dentists are anti-sugar. I grew up with this idea from my parents that dentists are anti-sugar. I quickly realized that was totally false when I got to dental school because there was sugar all over the place. What we realized is the important thing is to make sure we brush away the sugar. However, when you work in a dental office, you've got specialists and labs and people coming by and they're always dropping off all these chocolates and candies. And eventually, everyone's just munching on them. And eventually, I just became addicted to sugar. And you know you're addicted between patients. You just kind of grab a little bit of sugar. You take a little bit of sugar here. Take a little bit of sugar. And you know what it does? It does this little special thing in the pleasure center of my brain. I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, I knew this was not the right thing to do. And I had a little drawer in my desk with chocolates, and my associates knew that was there, too, because I'd look in there, and sometimes they'd be gone, and they were addicted to sugar, too, just like I was probably. But I knew deep down that, this is not good. But, you know, at a certain period, three friends of mine in a certain given amount of time all got cancer. And, you know, I thought about that, and I was like, you know, they say sugar feeds cancer. I don't know what the effect is, but, you know, this is not a good thing for me. And then I thought about my little girls and my sweet wife. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, this is something I've got to quit. And you know what? Right then, it was that simple. Now, do I still eat sugar? I still eat sugar, but I limit it to more like just after a meal, I'll eat sugar. But as far as the eating constantly throughout the day, all day long, once in a while, you know, they might bring something in, I might have it, but it's nothing like it was before. But what was the motivating factor for me? It was for those that I love, that are around me. So here's the point that I'm trying to make here, okay? What makes Dick Hoyt so spectacular? First, it's his amazing love for his son. He's able to be there for his son, and he is able to help enrich his son's life. I want to be like Dick Hoyt for my loved ones. Do you want to be that way for those people around you? Now, let me tell you what that means for you to be like Dick Hoyt. It means if you've got grandchildren, it means that you can run around and chase them down. And you can lift them up and carry them and play frisbee with their loved ones, making your grandchildren smile. If you love your grandchildren, the best way that you can show them your love, one of the best gifts that you can give to your loved ones, is to be healthy. To illustrate this point further, and we're almost coming to a close, here's two examples. You know, a lot of times, you know, I've heard people say things like this. You know, I'm going to enjoy what life has to offer. I'm going to eat what I want. I don't care to exercise. And, you know, if I suffer a little at the end, who cares? But, you know, when you get sick, you know who really suffers? It's the people that you love the most. You know how hard? Have you ever seen a family suffer as someone in their household has cancer and they're struggling with the disease? It's not just you that suffers. It's the family around you that really suffers. Also, if you have a disease, do you know who you become a burden to the most? It's not the caretakers. It's not to the doctors. It's those who are closest to you. When I was ill, I was the greatest burden to my wife. I don't want to be a burden to my wife. I don't want to be a burden to my kids. Not now, and not when I get older. And so those are some of the things that motivate me to want to take care of my health and my emotional well-being so that I can show them my love. Now, this is a quote that I love. This is also by the same author from the previous quote. It says, "It is in a life of service only that true happiness is found." Our happiness is tied directly to being a blessing to others. And most of us who have lived life a certain amount, we have realized this from our own experience, right? When you are sick, especially when it's an illness or disease that affects your mental capacity, it's very difficult to be of service to anybody else. You become a slave to your illness. You become consumed and occupied by your own pain and suffering. So do you see the connection between exercise and happiness that I'm trying to convey? Exercise is one of the things that you can participate in to maintain great mental and bodily health. And optimal health lends itself to allowing you to be a blessing to others, and therein is happiness found. So I'd like to end with this Bible text from 3 John 1, chapter 1, verse 2. "Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth. It is my prayer and wish that each of you would have optimal mental health, so that you can be a blessing to others and in return, experience true happiness." Thank you for your time.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.